I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 190 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. Our guest this week was a founding member of the legendary British post-punk band The Raincoats, and decades later is reaching new artistic heights, Gina Birch. She describes herself as a doer, a maker, and an experiencer. She's an artist and filmmaker who has directed videos for The Libertines, New Order, Daisy Chainsaw, and others. Her work was featured in the Tate Gallery's Women in Revolt exhibition in London last year, and her face, mid-outcry, was the poster image. Some female artists who were featured in that exhibition, plus others who have inspired Birch, appear on the recording and in the video of Making Trouble Again. That song, A Musical Statement of Purpose, is on Birch's new album, Trouble. Included in the video are Anna Da Silva and Shirley O'Loughlin from The Raincoats. Bassist singer Birch and guitarist singer Da Silva formed The Raincoats back in 1977. The band's 1979 self-titled debut album is an off-kilter classic, boasting jagged rhythms, funky dissonance, and a head-spinning cover of The Kinks' Lola. That album ranked number 398 on Rolling Stone's 2020 list of the 500 greatest albums of all time, and Kurt Cobain listed it as one of his all-time favorites. After recording two more albums, The Raincoats broke up in 1984, then regrouped 10 years later just in time to be invited to open for Nirvana for its UK tour dates. But a week before the tour was scheduled to begin, Cobain took his own life. Birch here reflects on that turn of events. The Raincoats went on to record one more album, 1996's Looking in the Shadows, and have performed sporadically since then. Birch also has worked with the band Red Crayola, formed the band Dorothy, and fronted The Hangovers, which released one album, 1998's Slow Dirty Tears. But Birch didn't release any music under her own name until the 2021 single, Feminist Song. When you ask me, if I'm angry, I say, I don't go ranting in post offices or point my gun out of my bedroom window at strangers. With the acclaimed 2023 album, I Play My Bass Loud following. I relate to the title track's opening line. Sometimes I wake up. Jack White's Third Man Records released both I Play My Bass Loud and the new Trouble with Youth producing. Birch incorporates more electronics into her music than in her early Raincoats days as she plays with dub, reggae, and rock textures while exploring the intersection of art and the often troublesome outside world. The new song Doommonger covers all of the above. Birch is fierce, funny, down-to-earth, and very smart as she tells how she approaches and creates her art. I gotta say, I love talking with and listening to her. I am sure you will share my enthusiasm. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Gina Birch. Where are you, by the way?
I'm in North London, Tufnell Park, it's called.
Nice.
Yeah, we moved here about 12 years ago from Westbourne Grove, which is where I spent all my formative punk Raincoats years. Squat to housing co-op to posh bit. It became very posh in Notting Hill. And, as all the money moved in, some of its soul disappeared. And all this, you could spend £500 on a belt.
That's what happens.
Yes. So the streets that were once ours became the streets of millions and billionaires.
I had about a month in Notting Hill when I was between sophomore and junior years in college. And that was a long time ago, though. So that would have been 84. There, I just dated myself. But yeah, I remember going down to the little, I think it was Reckless Records was right over there. And I picked up like all my copies of the British pressings of like more specials and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, because I moved there in 76. And, you know, and then Margaret Thatcher came to power in 79. And, you know, things became more about money. And then in the 80s, you know, and MTV started, everything started getting more and more about money in the early 80s. But it didn't really, really kick in until, well, I suppose there was the film, Notting Hill and all that. And then it just seemed to roll over and over until it kind of, yeah.
Well, thank goodness things aren't all about money anymore.
It's such a relief, isn't it?
Yeah, no, we're living in, look, I mean, I was going to ask you other stuff first, but your song Doommonger kind of sums up a lot of this stuff.
Well, it does, you know, it's quite funny because I wrote it quite a long time ago because, you know, it was becoming evident some years ago what was going on, but I hadn't quite predicted what's happening now. And there was the line, wish I could find out, wish I could work out where it's all gone wrong. And I was like, I've got to take that out because that's just really ridiculous. And now I think, actually, that's a very good line now. I mean, it feels more appropriate now than it did, 18 months ago. It's like where it's all gone wrong. It's like it's gone so strange. And I don't really want to talk about it at this point because we're coming in the autumn. It's gone so strange that it is a little hard to fathom. You know, you read people's critiques and you read where it might be going, but at the same time, it's a little hard to fathom quite how it got here. We got here. Ah.
I know, and how it continues to go, and then, look, a lot of artists, creative people. Almost anyone is sort of wrestling with that notion of how do you sort of do the sort of life affirming stuff that you want to do while also not, you know, not sort of turning a blind eye to that stuff, but also not being a doom monger where all you're doing is going, oh my God, you know, what's the point of any of this?
I have stopped watching the news basically because it's just so, so sad and so tragic. And you think, do we really need on a daily basis to fill our heads with the world's tragedy? So I try not to. And but then it feels like, you know, carelessness, or, you know, I just have to be grateful for my stuff, my lot, and do what I can, you know.
Do you think the role of the artist has changed through all of this? You know, the times now versus the times of when you started?
I don't know. I remember my brother saying to me, you know, when the Raincoat started and we were with Rough Trade and, you know, and punk was happening, and I thought there was a revolution going on. I really thought punk was, you know, causing a revolution. It felt like, I suppose when you're in the eye of the storm,
right,
it feels like everything's changing, everything's shifting. And then, of course, you know, came the new romantics musically, you know, and Margaret Thatcher, and you realize that actually, you had a little eye of the storm moment, and in a kind of creative sense, punk has had a longevity. But and now I'm so not analytical about it. To be honest, I really don't know. I mean, I don't listen to a lot of rap music and stuff, or grime, or things where people are kind of articulating certain political beliefs and stuff. And I suspect that around each group of musicians that are politically motivated, there is some kind of impact which causes a bit of a ripple, but never a tsunami. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, when the raincoat started, all of that was new. And I could see having that sense of we're really, you know, we really are revolutionaries, we're changing the world, because everything changed so much. I mean, from the 60s through the 70s, you know, into the 80s, kind of year by year, you could sort of see a change in, you know, music and approach and the impact that it had. And now it's very hard to sort of hear something and think, well, that's new. And it's also, there's so much input through, you know, the internet and social media and everything that it's just harder for things to stand out. And it's kind of what we were talking about in on the negative side before, in that, like, you're so, I'd thought when, you know, Twitter started, you're like, oh, this is going to be great because it's going to sort of shine a light on all the injustice in the world. But there's so much injustice in the world that people are like, ah, I can't take it all anymore. So there's a sort of inundation of stuff, and that makes it harder for things to stand out. And yet you still need the artists to create the art that moves the world in a better direction than we're going in now.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we always thought that the world was getting to, our little corner of the world was going to get better and better. But it just changes. And, you know, it's for all the advances, and there have been quite a lot of good things that have happened, there is an equal amount of bad stuff. And it's like, you know, popping, I was thinking, you know, like when there's, you're trying to flatten out the table and you push something down and it pops up over there, or flattening
right
down. But it's, you know, so I'm not really an analyst of this stuff. I'm a doer and a maker, and I like to kind of think a bit, but I'm an experiencer.
Right. Well, do you approach this doing differently, you know, over the years than you did when you started? I mean, has there been evolved in how you approach your art, or is it pretty consistent?
I think it's fairly consistent. I approach my art by just kind of by osmosis, letting things come in. And I mean, the first kind of album I did on Third Man, that those songs had been written over a period of time, apart from Rage, which I wrote just before I made the record, and I kind of co-wrote the kind of structure of it with Youth. But with this album, I wrote it all kind of sitting on the sofa, just letting thoughts kind of meander through my head. And apart from Doommonger, which I picked up from the first album. So, yeah, I think I it's been fairly consistent. I think, obviously, technology has come into play. And, you know, I have a great laptop, and I can do film. I've got all my films in my laptop and on drives. I've got all my music on my laptop and in drives. And I can do it on the train or, you know, anywhere. I can work anywhere. So that's a big shift. And the other thing that's been a big shift is that I took up painting about 10, 11 years ago, and I've taken that very seriously. And in a way, I've tried to paint in a kind of classical way and in a kind of more a punk kind of way. So I will almost copy a classical painting, and then I will maybe what Ivan Seeler, a painter friend of mine, called, I will vandalize it with my overseeing, you know, my current perspective on what might have been a painting that kind of I can both enjoy for the paint and hate for the subject or the way that the people within the painting are depicted or expected to be or behave or whatever.
Do you think that's similar to how you approach music and songwriting?
I can't play an instrument. I've been playing music for all these years, but I can't really play guitar. I can't really play bass. I can't really play the keyboard. But I do all of them. Whereas with painting, I've really tried to paint. Whereas I think if I were trying to do that same process with music, I would have taken like piano lessons, and I would have really learnt my scales and my chops and everything. Hmm. And I haven't, because in a way, the kind of punk roots go deeper within music. I don't know if that makes any sense or not, but somehow with music, I have never learnt. I don't know.
So you think you're a more skilled painter than bassist?
Given the time factor, you know, if I've been painting for 10 years and I've been playing music for 40.
The bass sounds pretty good to me, though. So, like, the idea that you say you can't play bass after all these years, when you have the bass up front and all these songs creating these kind of slinky grooves, surprises me.
Yeah, I can play a slinky groove, but you know, if you suddenly came up and said, "Hey, look, I got this song. Could you try some bass on it?" I'd be like, "What are the chords? Where?" I'll come back tomorrow with my slinky groove. But, you know, what I mean is I couldn't kind of riff off it. I couldn't.
You can't play other people's stuff so well, but you play your stuff very well.
What I might do is I might say, okay, I've got an idea for a song. I'll just get my bass out and I might write a little melody on it. And then I might put some beats with it. And then I start chanting or talking to it. So it's like a layer of embroidery or something, you know. It's like or I might play some guitar chords, you know. I might play a C, a G, a A minor, a D, you know, just basic old chords, and then I find a melody, and then I might dump the guitar, or I might, you know, I don't know if that explains it, but yes, I have my strengths, and I like playing high up on the neck of the bass. I like the extremes of the quality of the sound of the deep bass and the high notes. But if you were asking me to musically fill in, you know, I'm no Paul McCartney.
He didn't know how to read music either. I mean, he was all
he didn't
totally
know how to read music, but he was very musical.
He was.
And I'm a bit of a lemming. Say someone comes along and sings a harmony by the side of me, I start singing the harmony with them. It's an odd thing. I don't know. I mean, I suppose within the Raincoats, we did come from that kind of background of expression and ideas. You know, when I first went to art school, conceptual art was quite a kind of big thing, and I've always kind of liked the idea as much as anything, as much as the execution. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Right. Well, and when you started the Raincoats, you really didn't at that point know how to play bass, right?
Oh no, I didn't. But you know, eventually you find out. I learned one of my first patterns. From, you know, reggae records with Toots and the Maytals, you know, that I realized then that the bass line is a visual pattern. It's so really there's a set of visual patterns for me on the bass, and then I mess them up or slide around, and so that's how it works for me.
Right. Yeah, there were a lot of, I mean, the sort of the art school punk connection was strong. I mean, the Mekons, several of whom live in Chicago now. I mean, John Langford, I mean, I think when they started that band, they weren't particularly adept at their instruments. Now they're a great band, but it's also, they've been doing it for a really long time. But that's another, you know, you kind of had the art side of it. And, you know, Langford's also a painter, started as a drummer, now a guitarist, singer. So
I know, I think different people would have approached it in different ways. Anna and I have stayed on a level where neither of us have got brilliant at being musicians. We're both quite good at technology now, but neither of us are brilliant at either guitar or bass. But in a way, that's what gives us our strength. And we like it like that. Maybe it's kind of inverted snobbery, I don't know. But, you know, I just think there's a kind of many, many people, and maybe boys, men particularly, they want to be good at the guitar. You know what I mean? You get your guitar and you want to be good. You want to play those chops, those licks, you know. How does he do that? Oh, I must find out and I'll learn. And yeah, and I'm a bit more like that with painting. That's what I was saying.
Interesting.
I'm like that with painting. How did they get that effect? How do you do that? Do you sand that down? Do you smear that? Do you splat it? What do you do? You know, what's that material that they're using? Why is it like this? Why is it like that? Not with music.
Right. But the idea of punk was basically anti-virtuoso in the first place, right? That it was sort of a democratic thing that anyone could play. So the point wasn't that you had to be a brilliant musician. The point was that you had to have something to say and a passionate way of saying it.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. My punk roots go deeper in music because of that ideology, in a way, that learning to play brilliantly would not be part of that ethic. when I'm saying this, but it's true.
Do you feel like when you're creating music now, and I want to talk to you about your solo albums in a second, you know, as part of this, but when you're creating music now, do you feel like you're able to achieve what you want to achieve? Like in your head, when you imagine a song, are you able to do what you want, or are you like, oh, I'm too limited to achieve this?
No, I never feel I'm too limited to achieve this, because basically within things like Logic and different programs, there's all sorts of sounds, and I roll through those sounds and I audition sounds from there that most people wouldn't even dream of putting that with this. But I think, oh, I wonder what that would be like here. I wonder what that would be like there. So I'm like the conductor, in a way, of not my own playing, but of sound, a soundscape of sounds. And so am I limited? Have I got limitations? No, not really. I mean, I think the thing is that sometimes you need parameters in order to push things around. You know, if I had every sound in the world and I could play every instrument and I could play the harp and the banjo and the blah, 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 God knows, I'd be a complete mess. Do you think? I mean,
well, so my point being that you're, you know, when you're saying, oh, I didn't become a good musician or whatever, it's like it seems like you became a great musician for the music that you're trying to create, because you're able to create exactly what you want to create, as opposed to, you know, thinking, oh my God, I have this really amazing guitar solo that should go here, but I just can't shred like that. You know, like that's not what's going on.
Well, if I did want to, I might ask a friend, can you do this?
Yeah.
I mean, I that's the interesting thing about, I mean, I've got this laptop. I can say, hey, you guy down the road, could you come and, I mean, the woman who played on cello song, she lives a few houses down on the other side of the road. And I met her and she walked along with her cello and we plugged it in my kitchen. I plugged my mic in the kitchen and she played it by the kitchen table, by the undone washing up, you know, and I use that. I mean, you can still hear the little bit of the click on the beginning of the track where she was playing along to the click track. So yeah, I mean, you know, and I like a little cat meowing on the tracks here and there, or, you know, or the sound of, I mean, I like on Happiness, I really like the thunderstorm, you know. It was funny because we had a series of thunderstorms in the last few days, which have kind of made me appreciate the thunderstorm in Happiness. I don't know if you even noticed it, but it's very evident.
Right. That's funny. So your entire career, you didn't have any solo albums until 2023, and you had the album I Play My Bass Loud. And it starts with a line that I relate to, which is, sometimes I wonder, what is my job?
Yeah.
And your answer to that is, I play my bass loud. As opposed to, I play my bass loud and I also paint and all this other stuff. But so clearly the playing the bass is, you know, loud is, you know, a key part of your identity.
Well, yeah, it was funny because I was standing by my old computer, a kind of tower, and I had the base around my neck, and I was at the kind of bay window, and the track was going along, and I thought, sometimes I wake up and I wonder, what is my job? And there I am with the bass around my neck, and I go, I play my bass loud. And of course, I thought that line, those lines would be idiotic, never used. But what I realize actually is that those kind of lines, those thoughts that flash through your brain, are actually thoughts that other people flash through other people's brains as well in a kind of odd way. And so, not the bass loud bit, but and what seemed absurd is also kind of perfect. So yeah, it was a surprise to me when it kind of worked. I don't know if it happens to you when you write something and you think, I'll replace that in a while.
Sure.
And then you come back to it later and you go, actually, that's quite good.
No, there are a lot of, you know, rock or, you know, any of us, it's full of, you know, the things that you think, oh, that's just sort of filler. And they're like, ah, that's something. It was like, I mean, the story of, you know, Hey Jude, where Paul had written, you know, the movement you need is on your shoulder, which he always thought he'd replaced. And John was like, no, you need to keep that. It's a great line.
I still don't get it, but I, yeah.
But it feels right. You know, you'll sing along with it. So, but also I play my bass loud. Also, it just, it feels like a great statement. Like now, if you'd said, I play my bass with the expert precision of a musician who's been studying the craft for 40 years, it just wouldn't have the same effect as I play my bass loud.
I know it's funny. And I thought it was a good title for the song. And then I was trying to work out a title for the album. And you thought said, oh, you know, it should be called I Play My Bass Loud. And he said, if I saw an album in a shop called I Play My Bass Loud, I would buy it. And I thought, oh, well, yeah, okay. I don't really like having the name of the album being the name of one of the songs. I mean, I remember Jack White saying to me once that I really like I Play My Bass Loud. And I thought he meant the song. And then I realized later he might have meant the album. And I was like, if I'd known he meant the album, I would have kind of responded and said, oh, what aspects, what do you like, which songs and so on and so forth. But I missed my chance because that conversation was short. I just thought he liked the song. And so, yeah, there's always a bit of confusion when you've got the name of a song being the name of the album.
So in this case, the new one is, the album's called Trouble. And then you have the third song is called Causing Trouble Again. So it's kind of the title track, but you could at least, if someone says, I love Causing Trouble Again, you know they mean the song.
Yes, yes. If they say, I love trouble, I know what they mean. So yes, I think there's just enough difference there.
There you go. So, okay, so how did it take you, like your entire career to make your first album and, you know, again, obviously you've made other albums and you've been, you know, had your artistic vision represented on Hangovers Records, Raincoats, any of this stuff. But then two years to do the second album. How did that work?
Well, you know, in a way the Hangovers was kind of, it was my project, you know, and the people came and went. So, but I didn't want to call it Gina Birch because it felt like a collective of musicians with input. Whereas with this, the first one, Bass Loud, when you have a bit of technology like a computer, you put something down and then you come back to it. And it's like yourself, it's like your diary in a way. You can then play along with yourself because you can then put something over the top. I mean, like, you know, back to Paul McCartney, he can play every track on one of his, every instrument on one of his songs. And in a way, there's something about it that it's much easier to be a solo artist with a computer because you can talk to yourself. You know, I could put down a line, a lyric, and then I can answer it. It's almost like the chorus in a medieval drama or something. You know, it's like I I felt that a lot with I Will Never Wear Stilettos, you know, that it was kind of like I was almost chatting to myself, having a two-way conversation, like a game of chess on your own, you know, and music on a computer is more like that. Yeah, I don't know. Am I making any sense?
Of course you are. And was it more of a leap for you also to put out an album under the name Gina Birch as opposed to putting out an album under, you know, a band name and you're part of it and you know how much you did, but it's not your name right out front?
Yeah, well, I think basically, you know, Dave Buick from Third Man had come to London, was interested in maybe the Raincoats making a 7-inch for the launch of the new shop and the new label. And Anna and Shirley didn't want to do it. And I had Feminist Song. And I said, well, you know, it had been knocking around for quite a while. And I said, well, I'd like to do it. And they said, yeah, you do it. You know, it's your song. You do it as Gina Birch. And so I did as the 7-inch. And then, you know, there was discussion of whether I had any more material. And I was like, I've got the whole album's worth of material and more, you know. And so suddenly there I was Gina Birch, because I had been working with my computer on my own for a long time, alongside painting and the other stuff. So I was kind of ready, and it was me. I worked a Helen McCookery book, who I made a film with called Stories from the Sheepunks, music with a different agenda. She'd come and done some song structure with me and some backing vocals and stuff. And so that was nice to work with somebody else from time to time. And then, of course, at the time of I Play, when Helen and I were deciding we were going to make this film, we were about to fundraise, and I thought I would use I Play My Bass Loud as a fundraiser. And I thought I would get some of the women who were in the film or around the film to come and play bass on I Play My Bass Loud. So I'd have five women bass players on this record. And then, of course, that just didn't work. I mean, I don't know if you know anybody who's had a successful fundraising scheme, but I think I sold one pound or something. I mean, you know, you've got to have reach, haven't you? And so that became the beginning of the album. I don't know, Occupy was in America as well, wasn't it? I made a great big opus about Occupy, you know, the movement of the banks movement. And I that still remains unreleased. But I have, you know, I do have songs from various kind of political moments that I thought, oh, that's interesting to kind of write a little mini opera about this or that, you know. And so...
Is that something you've already recorded and you just haven't released?
Yes. I mean, because then Occupy came and it went. And then by the time, you know, Occupy's like 5 years back, you know, who needs to know about Occupy anymore? But maybe when 25 years have passed, then it's interesting. Do you know what I mean? There's a moment in history with something that is the right moment for it.
Maybe people need to be reminded already of Occupy.
Yeah, maybe they do. What an ending. I mean, we bailed all the banks out. Why? You know, it's just like crazy.
Are you someone who's just constantly writing and creating music, and then, you know, when the idea comes up to make an album, like I Play My Bass Loud or now Trouble, you just sort of have the material because you've been accumulating it, as opposed to, oh, I want to create a project, so I'm going to sit down and do that project?
Well, yes and no, but I mean, things are just percolating all the time. You know, I might be driving my car and then, you know, the indicators, when you've got your indicators going, sometimes you're like thinking about an idea and then I was like, keep to the left, no, right turn, because, you know, you're driving along and then I thought, well, I'll have a little go with that. And so, you know, just simple ideas just kind of come around. I think basically my training as an art student and an artist is antennae. You know, I have my antennae just kind of picking up on things and swooping around and bending over there or over there. So Yes, as long as I might make a note of them, or I might forget them, or, you know, depends if you remember them. I mean, I remember, back to Paul McCartney, there's so much Beatles stuff around, or there has been, you know, and it's like, when him and John would write a song, if they didn't remember it the next day, it wasn't a great song because they couldn't remember it, you know, so it's like an idea is percolating, and if it kind of comes to the surface at the right moment, it's because that's what happens, you know.
Well, and it sounds like you're constantly receptive to that, because I think that there's some people who kind of turn off their receptors and then they'll be like, okay, now I have to sort of engage. But whereas other people like yourself, it sounds like the antennae are always up. You don't retract them. And so at any moment you can be inspired by something still.
I think that's true. I mean, Mayo Thompson used to say he said I had antennae. I don't think he actually ever said I didn't have a brain, but I have a better antennae than a brain. I don't think you quote him on that, but you know what I mean? It's like I have feelings for things. Mayo is specifically analytical. And that is not something I really can boast about in my own case. I have responses to things, but sometimes they're well thought through and sometimes they're emotional.
With the song Causing Trouble again, where there's also a video of it with there are all these guest stars on it and all these voices on it, what was kind of the evolution of that song? Like how did it get from, you know, your idea to just having so many artists who either you name check or who are actually sort of shouting along with it by the end?
Well, that, you know, basically, I met Lindsay Young, the curator of Women in Revolt at the Tate Britain in London, and I had made various Super 8 films when I was at art school, and one of Lindsay's friends had seen some of my Super 8s, so she was interested in including this Super 8 I'd made of a 3-minute scream, a piece of conceptual art, obviously, on Super 8. She'd seen that, she wanted to project it within the show, which I was thrilled about, because when I was at art school, I never showed it to anybody, you know, kind of a bit, I never showed anybody any work because who cares what these young girls were doing? We weren't really at the forefront of anybody's dreams or imagination. You know, we didn't have the kind of role models to aspire to. We were just doing our stuff, you know. So the Raincoats at that time was a great outlet for me because the artwork that I made, I kind of mostly kept to myself. Anyway, so there I was, and Lindsay said she wanted to project it at 3 meters wide, and she wanted me to be the poster image, and that was like amazing. So when the show opened, there were 100 women who'd made work between 1970 and 1990. And many of us were obviously a little older than, you know, the young acolytes, whatever. And the opening night, we were all there, but we were all surrounded by our friends and family. And I always thought it's so important in a way that us group of 100 women would stick together. We would raise each other up. We would have a kind of movement. We would be as one, if you like. Anyway, we never got everyone's email. So at some point, you know, there was a kind of privacy issue. So at some point I said to Lindsay, could you email all the women from Women in Revolt to send me on my mobile phone a name or two or three of women who've inspired them, who've been troublemakers, or who've just generally they felt has given them courage or whatever, joy, pleasure, whatever. And I got about 5-10 from there, but not that many, not as many as I was hoping for, you know. So then I kind of broadened it out to artists that I knew, painters, filmmakers, musicians. And then the names started coming in. And I thought then, you know, I could just see this kind of huge kind of pile or tower of of pieces of paper with women's names on, you know, that might be, or if there was a slight breeze, they might be in this big room in the gallery and they might be fluttering around, you know, and there'd be all these women. The energy of the names of all these women would be there, and it would be like this amazing kind of sculpture. But then, you know, I thought it's good to have them perhaps in the song. So, because I'd started just writing a song about, I was thinking, you know, women in revolt causing trouble again. So I started writing the song, and then I started to put some of the names in, and, you know, there's Cosy Fanny Tutti and Caroline Kuhn, and just Caroline left a wonderful message on my landline, you see. So, and she's very like, this is Caroline Kuhn calling for Gina, causing trouble again, and very kind of clear. And I was like, okay, well, I quite like to have that in there. And then the names for me are still like a kind of giant fluttering pile of female energy or creativity or trouble. And at the end, I just kept them going, you know, kept it going until all the names I had were done.
Were the names all ones that other people suggested, or did you sort of throw your own in as well?
I wanted other people to suggest them, basically. I thought it was important that, yes, because if you're going to ask me who I would choose, I can't say right now because there's so many. And right. All my children are my favorites.
Now you're going from like Nina Simone, Yoko Ono, Stormy Daniels. It's a pretty broad spectrum.
When I heard it was a woman, one of the women from Sea Red poster group who put Stormy Daniels at the end of some kind of quite political names, and I was like, it just really cracked me up, you know. But of course it was brilliant too, you know.
And then you also had all these artists who were singing with you on the song as well, including Anna.
In the video, yes, because I had thought, you see, I would put up pictures of all the kind of more famous women, and then everyone was going, copyright, can't do that. I thought, okay, well, I'll just get all the women who are able to turn up on the day to send me a photograph of themselves. So why can't we be these women, you know? So they're not the women from the exhibition, and they're not even necessarily the women who speak on the record. They're just the artist women who could make it that day, you know? And there's Anna and Shirley from the Raincoats. There's people from all different bands and parts of my life.
What was it like for you to have all those people from the sort of This Is Your Life crowd around you on that track for that video?
Well, it was great. It was great. I mean, the day before the video shoot, we'd been out in the car filming. I was in the back of this like little two-door car with a big ladder and jumping out and running across the street. And then the beginning of the film, you know, I was quite exhausted, you know. I'd done all the pre-production of the 30 women, getting them all there, and I'd been painting white ladders and God knows what, and organizing clothes and outfits. So the day of the actual shoot, I was feeling quite well in the morning, and everybody kept saying to me, "Have you eaten? Have you eaten?" And I was going, "No, I'm not hungry. I don't want to eat. Have you eaten?" And eventually, I was persuaded to eat, and then I was just taken over by a wave of enormous tiredness. And by the time all the women came, I was like, I could barely stand up. It was quite bizarre, really. I don't know if that's ever happened to you, but I was just like, in those circumstances, do not eat.
Wow. I thought you were going to say you rejuvenated, it gave you energy, but nope.
No, it was quite the opposite. Well, that's what everyone was hoping for me, you see. But I thought I was doing fine until the moment where I ate, because the moment I ate, all the blood went to my stomach to deal with the food, you know. And I was having to stand up, and because I was co-directing, you know, and I don't know, you know, if you when you have a party, sometimes you invite everybody you've ever known, or everybody who, you know, you invite so many people who you have missed hanging out with, and you feel a bit guilty, so you invite them, and then they all turn up, and you're like, oh my God, how am I going to cope with everybody? You know, so there was a bit of that, so that 30 women who I, you know, suddenly all from different backgrounds, they were all really excited to meet each other.
So you could process it more later, because at the moment you're crashing because of the food, and you're also just trying to direct a lot of traffic.
Yeah, it was, you know, one has, I find moments of pure joy or something happen unexpectedly. The moments where you think they're going to be often aren't. So I was just talking about earlier, I played a solo gig as a benefit for Resonance Radio, and I was on the stage and I was just transformed into a zone that I very, very, very rarely have been in. And I don't know where it came from, how I reached it or why it happened, but it just happened one day. And I would have, you know, I would have liked to have thought that shoot would have been a zone moment.
Mm.
I'd love to tell you it was. In fact, I could just tell you it was and you wouldn't know the difference.
Well, I would now.
I've told you, yeah.
And the idea of causing trouble again, do you feel like there's an urgency to do that right now?
I think there's a continued need for it. I mean, it's always one step forward, one step back. Every advancement. And, you know, so much... I don't want to just talk about women because there's so much stuff to talk about, but so much work hidden, you know, so much work that women have made over the years, artwork, they've kept hidden. They've kept in their pockets. They haven't specifically hidden it, but it's been unexplored. So you might get, you know, a beautiful piece of sol wit or, you know, some great male artist that, had it been made by a woman, would have been potentially dismissed. Do you know what I mean? It's like, because it was made out of cake or it was knitted, or that it was women's stuff, you know, and therefore unworthy. And so with regard to women's creativity, I think that there's a lot of work to be done. I felt that, like, the Tate should have kept a room that kind of continued Women in Revolt, because at the exhibition, it was such a meeting place of young and old and middle women and men who were discovering this work and discussing it, debating it, enjoying it. It was one of the best attended exhibitions because it was diverse. I mean, it was funny because Yoko Ono had a big solo show in Tate Modern when that was on at Tate Britain. And Yoko's show was quite stunning too. Obviously, it was stunning. And I mean, as I was growing up, you know, in the UK, she was much, much derided. you know, people couldn't quite understand what was going on there. And so, yeah, it was a great moment when Yoko had her show at Tate Modern, and we were all on at Tate Britain. And in fact, yeah, I did a live performance at Tate Britain when our show was on, and it was around December, so I did a version of "Listen, the Snow is Falling," Yoko Ono song. And yeah, so I think there's always a place for advancement or causing trouble. I mean, the thing is, it's quite strange because each generation has their own interests or obsessions. And I have two daughters who are both in their 20s, and both of them, like in America, I mean, it's only recently in the last kind of 10 years, we've had to pay school fees, get loans for our university education. And then those loans are privatized. And then when you finally get a job, and I think it's the same in America, your loan is, say, $60,000. You can get a job, be paying it off all year, and find you owe $70,000 at the end of the year because the interest on the loan is so high. And, I mean, when I was a student, we'd have sit-ins for things that were much, much less than ending up owing hundreds of thousands to the government. But young people they're not protesting about that. They're protesting about trans rights and, gender identity and so on and so forth. And so each generation has their different way of engaging with the world and fighting their causes and their fights. And sometimes I think maybe we're being misdirected to, look over here and don't worry about this one here. You know, it's hard to know quite what's going on there.
Right. Certainly when you feel like you're just money dominates so much of the conversation, you just end up sort of more behind the eight ball than ever before. It feels a lot of things feel more rigged than ever. Yeah. How do you fight it? And are people even inspired to rally against that stuff?
Yes. I don't know. I mean, it seems we're being asked to look the other way.
Yeah. What do you think the state of women in the music world right now is?
It's odd. It's interesting. It's hard. Yeah, I mean, you know, I've never really been a big kind of chart type person. But if I observe the charts, you know, I see Amel and the Sniffers. She's quite interesting. I mean, you know, the way she dresses and what she does, you think, well, that shouldn't work. But it does somehow. It's really good. And then there's Wet Leg, and that's kind of bizarre. And there's Lorde, and she's kind of great. You know, Beyonce. I mean, I've never really listened to Beyonce very much, but I did just listen to her a bit the other day, and I thought, you know, I mean, obviously she's extremely talented and well positioned to have, you know, to make great work. It's not kind of grabbed me, does it? What do you think of Beyonce?
I appreciate that Beyonce is kind of looking out into the world and processing stuff as opposed to just making it all about, you know, herself and her relationships. So I admire her a lot. I don't musically gravitate toward it that much. I haven't seen her live. My wife has, and, you know, had a great time. I respect her a lot. I think she's really interesting. I think, you know, reclaiming country music and just the genre kind of stuff she's done is pretty cool. I haven't personally, like, it hasn't sort of stuck on my turntable the way other artists have necessarily, but that's, you know, that's music.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think sometimes there's a kind of, you know, I don't listen to Beyonce. I haven't bought a Beyonce record because why would I listen to Beyonce? But actually, if I listen to Beyonce, I probably quite like it. Do you know what I mean? So I do tend to listen to things that are a bit more kind of left field, but not that much left field, you know. My love Yola Tengo, you know, it's like this. I love Kim Gordon, you know, maybe they're people more of my generation.
Right. And they're still around too, so that's good. Yeah. Just to rewind, you know, real quick on the Raincoats. You know, obviously a lot was talked about how, you know, Kurt Cobain talked about how much he loved the Raincoats, and you were supposed to open, what was it, a European or British tour for them right before he took his own life. At that point, before that happened, did you think, oh, we're going on this kind of different trajectory? And have you sort of thought about kind of like the sort of what would have happened if this had happened or that had happened?
No, more recently I did think about that, yes. But at the time, I wasn't thinking about that. You know, it was very odd that we got to make another record with Geffen. And it was because we hadn't really heard of Nirvana before Kurt arrived in London with Courtney. And we listened and we loved the records so much, and Kurt just seemed like a really interesting and amazing person. And more recently, I've thought how sad that we didn't really get to do that tour and hang out. But, you know, if we'd been playing in these massive places, I think we would have got quite a lot of derision as well. Cause like when we played with UB40 or The Beat, I can't remember, a Jobs for Youth thing in Birmingham once. And everyone emptied their pockets, throwing things at us, you know, we were like ducking these missiles because they just thought, what the hell is this, you know? And I think Kurt would have obviously defended us like the others in Nirvana too, but there was an element of like, what the hell would that be like? You know, it'd be nice to be with the Buzzcocks too. And it would have been the most amazing experience, but it would have had its scary bits too.
All have sort of career aspirations at that point, or?
No, we've never had career aspirations. No. I mean, I had a pop band called Dorothy, and that was kind of a bit of a career aspiration. But the Raincoats, I think it just didn't, it wasn't about career, because we just wanted to make then what we wanted to make. The guy from Geffen did say, oh, you know, you're going to sell 15,000 records. I mean, that sounds like nothing, doesn't it? Well, it probably does sound quite a lot now, but, you know, we've sold probably that number since, you know, over the years, you know, we've got our own label and we sell records all the time. People come to us to buy them, you know. But we've never had career aspirations. The money just trickles in very small and very slowly.
Was the experience with Geffen a good one?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think it's like with major labels, they've got a lot of money. And they sometimes think if they give you a lot of money and you go into a posh studio with a good producer and you get a good lawyer, you're going to make a good record. But, you know, I heard Brian Eno saying, you know, good records are usually made with a limited budget and a limited amount of time. You know, so you can give us a lot of money, you can give us a great studio, and you can give us a great producer, but it doesn't make a better record. In fact, it kind of tips the scales in an odd kind of way, if you know what I mean. And then, you see, we were going to make a second record, but then the money, the advance that they gave us was going to be X amount of pounds, but then they'll deduct the amount that we spent in the studio on the first record and the amount that was paid to the producer and the lawyer, and then give us the £18 left over as the kind of payoff for the second record. So, you know, was it a good experience with Geffen? Yes and no. I think major labels are, you know, there are many passionate people within major labels, but there is also it's a business, and it's about making money and how do we do it. And if we, I mean, they all know, must know, just throwing a lot of money at something does not make a good record, but sometimes it feels like they might think it is.
And now you're recording for Third Man, and that's been a good experience.
Oh, yes.
Seems like you're doing exactly what you want to do, so.
Yeah, and, you know, it's limited budget and limited time. And I just get on with it. And I paint the covers and work out what's going on, and I do a lot of the work myself and, you know, make my own videos. And so, yeah.
You chose to work with Youth as the producer?
Yeah, it was interesting because I was playing a show at something for the Idler magazine. I don't know if you've ever seen the Idler magazine, Tom Hodgkinson's project. And I was playing at the end of a festival thing, and Youth turned up with Vivian Goldman. They were going to do a play after me. And Youth just sat down and he was like, that's one of the best live shows I've ever seen. Because I was just playing with my guitar and some bits of tape and had bits of stuff going on. And he really loved it. And then when I was doing Feminist Song, I asked him to do a mix, like a dub mix for the B-side. So he did. And then when Dave Buick really liked Youth, who's my man from Third Man, and he said, well, why don't we have a few days with Youth and try it out? And it was at that point I took Rage, the song Rage, with me, which was kind of a long, rageful poem, really. And he said, where's the chorus? I said, chorus? I don't know. And he said, well, Rage, that's the chorus, Rage. And then he said, you need a little pre-chorus in there. I'm like, pre-chorus? And they said, have we got any words? And I said, oh, yeah, I've got this bit that goes, please don't ask me to be reasonable. I'm just not listening. We put that in, and then it led to the chorus. And I thought, blimey, we've written a kind of pop song on my first few hours in the studio, you know. So we kind of, we hit it off then, and then we continued to make the record together. You know, he always likes to know where the chorus is, and I'm like, chorus? You know, you know, I suppose we were kind of a bit anti that structure, but it works, you know. So,
right.
I had written a middle eight for Rage. That was the thing. I thought I'd written this kind of long meandering poem, but I had got a little bit of a middle eight. So, yeah.
And then coming back to do the second album, was it just, you know, just comfortable and, you know, picking up where you started off?
Yeah, I mean, we had the same engineer, and I think Michael did a bit more was a bit more at the helm than Youth in a way that time. But we did work together a lot on a few songs before I went in to do the album. We worked a bit on Live Forever, so you can see there's a bit of a chorus in there. That's Youth likes that thing, and it really works. It really lifts, you know, and we also did I Can't Sleep, but he's not happy with that because I kept rejecting his more pop approach to it. So.
And then you're going to be touring the US in the fall. I think you're coming to Chicago in like October at Lincoln Hall, I think I saw.
It's in October, yes. You'll have to announce the dates because I can't.
Yeah, I'll look it up. But your touring is a three-piece?
Yes, there will be three of us. And my two colleagues, when we were playing Rage live, I would say, stand back off your mics and yell, please don't ask me to be reasonable. I'm just not listening. And so they do. I mean, not quite as crudely as that, but they shout, please don't ask me to be reasonable. And so one day I said, I'm going to call you the Unreasonables. So that's how that name was born. So
oh, that's it.
The Unreasonables.
From that song, that's funny. So Gina Birch and the Unreasonables. Do the songs feel different to you when you play them live? Because you really kind of created them with the computers and everything, and then all of a sudden putting them on stage is really a different thing.
Well, it's taken us quite a few rehearsals to untangle them in a way. And so we haven't played a live show yet. We're playing that on the 16th of July, our first live show. The album comes out on July 11th, and then we're playing Rough Trade East on July 16th. And we're going to be like, it's a whole new, it's leaping off a cliff, really, because they are a bit, particularly Don't Fight Your Friends. We've made that, it's kind of quite, it's a kind of drum track, and us, we kind of do things in kind of layers and rounds, and there's a really nice new bass line on it and percussion as well. And so that's going to be our opening song, Don't Fight Your Friends, and it's quite unlike the album.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait to hear it and see when you get over here. So
good.
That'll be fun. Thank you so much. This has been really fun, and I really enjoyed talking with you. And you know, I can't wait to hear the rest of your stuff and to see you perform it all.
Well, thank you very much. Brilliant.
Thank you very much. That's it for episode 190 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Gina Birch for exploring her artistic life with such wit and insight. Her new album Trouble came out July 11th on Third Man Records. You can buy it from the label's website, thirdmanrecords.com, and elsewhere. Birch will be touring North America with her trio, The Unreasonables, in October. You can find the live dates on the Third Man site as well. Follow Birch on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads. Caro Pop is produced by Chris Wake, who plays his drums loud. Thanks to all who support Caro Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Caro Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at caropop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caro Pop on the so-called socials at Caro Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at M-A-R-K-C-A-R-O. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caro Pop conversation. Thanks.